So the topic of today's lecture is cost of capital. And this is a key lecture in the module. We've reached an important point in our story. Because at several points already, I've referred to the need to estimate the value of big R, the discount rate that we will use in our discounted cash flow calculations, in calculating net present value in particular. So this lecture is all about big R. You might want to write big R on the first slide to remind you that's what we're talking about. It's one of the more unfortunate names that finance academics have settled on, cost of capital, because I'm only too aware that students who are learning finance for the first time misunderstand what's meant by that phrase. They think cost of capital is an amount of money. It is not. The cost of capital is a percentage rate of return. It's critical that you get that clear in your mind now. The cost of capital, to give it its full name, the opportunity cost of capital, is also known as the discount rate. It's also known as the hurdle rate. Four different names for the same quantity that we will typically just refer to as big R. I've already spelt out for you that the way we go about appraising new investments. Now, we've tended to focus so far on investments in real assets, but the same techniques can be applied to investments in financial assets. The way we go about it is to calculate the net present value. We're looking to check whether the net present value is positive or negative. And there are two distinct steps to calculating net present value. The first step involves identifying and quantifying the incremental cash flows out into the future. So you're used to by now seeing me draw cash flow diagrams like this one. So the first part of the task is to forecast the incremental cash flows out into the future. And you need to understand the meaning of the word incremental. The seminar questions this week should have helped you do that. So being clear in your mind about what are the cash flows, the incremental goes to the heart of what difference to the overall level of cash flows for the company as a whole, what difference does undertaking this new project make? And remember, it's critical that you identify and include any opportunity costs. If taking on the new project has a knock-on effect on some existing projects, you must take that into account. So we need the incremental cash flows. So this first step is all about forecasting the numbers that go upstairs. In each term, on the right-hand side of the equation for the net present value. That leaves us to sort out, as the second step, what is the value of big R to use? What is the discount rate? And that's what this lecture is all about, because that is the cost of capital. Now, what I want you to be clear about, I've hinted at it enough, we're going to see how it works in more detail in this lecture. What I want you to be clear about is that the value of big R we use reflects the level of risk associated with the investment. But as I'm about to tell you, it's not any form of risk. It's only the component of risk that the financial markets recognize. It's only the component of risk that the financial markets themselves reward with additional return. And we give that component of risk a name, and now you need to start to use that name, systematic risk. Shortly, I'm going to tell you how we measure systematic risk. But what I want you to be clear about whenever we appraise a new investment, our technique is to calculate the net present value and to compare that value with zero. We'll be checking to see if the net present value is positive or negative. It's the next step I'm about to tell you that lots of students don't appreciate. I want you to appreciate it. The reason we compare the net present value we calculate with zero is zero is the value of the net present value for the corresponding financial markets investment. What we're doing when we calculate the net present value for our new project is we're comparing how good is that project with the best alternative, and the best alternative is always to invest the money instead in the financial markets. Because we believe the financial markets are highly efficient at pricing the securities that trade in the financial markets, the NPV of those financial securities, and therefore any portfolio of those securities that we choose to construct, the NPV is zero. So what I want you to understand is, when we are comparing our calculated NPV with zero, what we're actually doing is comparing how much value does our new project add compared to investing the money instead in the financial markets. That's the logic of what we're doing. But we have to make sure it's a fair comparison. We have to make sure that we adjust correctly for the level of risk associated with the project. Now, the financial markets only reward us for taking on risk that we cannot ourselves get rid of by diversifying. Diversification is the technique whereby we don't invest all of our money in one financial security. We spread the money across a portfolio of securities. Securities whose prices will behave in different ways. What we're taking advantage of there is the offsetting behaviour. The prices of some of the securities will go up. The prices of some other securities will go down. By forming a portfolio, we're taking advantage of the offsetting nature. Some go up, some go down. The overall value of the portfolio won't change by so much. The risk is reduced. Now, what you'll learn in more detail next year when you go on to Finance 1 is you cannot, by means of diversification, get rid of all of the risk. You can only get rid of a component of the risk. The component of risk that you can't get rid of, that you're left with, that's the systematic risk. And that part is rewarded by the financial markets with additional return. So in order for us to get anywhere at all in this lecture, we now have to confront this issue of systematic risk. And that's quite a complicated story, and we can't get into it in too much detail. I have to leave that to Finance 1 to do properly. But we can take on board what I know Finance 1 is going to tell you. We can take the result and work with that. We can take it on trust. And so what you'll learn next year in Finance 1, when you study diversification, when you start to unpick risk into its different components, you will learn properly what systematic risk is and how the market prices it properly. What I'm going to tell you is we need to know a number. For each and every investment, we need to know a particular number that will tell us how much systematic risk is present. And that number is called beta. So, my way of telling you how much systematic risk is present is by telling you what is the beta of the investment. You'll learn much more about beta next year. We're just take what it is we need to know. Now, there are a number of things I can, and hopefully in the course of this lecture, will tell you about beta. The first thing I want you to understand is it's a number. It doesn't have any dimensions. What beta is actually telling us is how much systematic risk does our investment have compared to the market as a whole. That's why it's a number with no units or dimensions, because it's comparing two amounts of systematic risk. If you like, it's a coefficient of proportionality. It's a scale factor. The beta tells us how much systematic risk have we got in our investment compared to the market as a whole. Well, just pause for a minute. Suppose the investment we're considering is the market as a whole. What do I mean by that? I mean, suppose we're thinking of investing our money in what we call a tracker fund. That's a portfolio of securities that's designed to mimic the stock market index. So, for instance, the FTSE 100 is made up out of the 100 largest stocks by market capitalization. The proportions reflect the market capitalizations of the 100 largest stocks. So someone puts together a portfolio in exactly those proportions. That's called a tracker fund, and you can invest money in it. What's the beta of that fund? Well, beta measures how much systematic risk in our investment compared to the market as a whole. If our investment is the market as a whole, then that ratio must be 1. So there's something new we've learned about beta. The beta takes the value of 1 when you're looking at the market as a whole. So there's a point of reference. 1, a value of 1 for beta, is indicating the overall level of systematic risk in the market as a whole. The market as a whole, we believe, is highly diversified. So that really is all systematic risk. Our individual investment will have a systematic risk component and a non-systematic risk component. And it's only the systematic risk component that matters when it comes to deciding what is the value of big R. So the magic number we need to know for our investment is beta. If the beta of our investment is bigger than 1, that's telling us that the amount of systematic risk associated with our investment is greater than the level of risk of the market as a whole. If you're wondering, how can an individual investment have greater systematic risk than the market as a whole, is because the market as a whole is a well-diversified portfolio. We've pared down the level of risk to the absolute minimum. And if our beta is bigger than 1, then our investment is exposed to greater systematic risk than the market as a whole. And therefore, we will demand a bigger value of big R than we would demand if we were just tracking the financial markets. On the other hand, if the beta of our investment is less than 1, then the level of systematic risk associated with our investment is not as great as the systematic risk associated with the market as a whole, so we'll insist on a lower value of big R. So what I hope you're getting the hang of is that the correct risk-adjusted value of big R goes up or down depending on the value of beta. Maybe you think it's a silly analogy. You decide for yourself. But you could think of the systematic risk, you could think of that as a measure of heat. How much heat is present? The value of big R is the corresponding temperature. So what I'm about to show you, I'm going to show you as a graph, it's playing the part of a thermometer. It's enabling us to convert an amount of heat, i.e. systematic risk, into a temperature, i.e. a rate of return, a discount rate, a value for big R. That's what we're doing. So here is your thermometer, and you've seen it before. It's just now we're going to put all the flesh on the bones. It's not likely in this module that you'll get confused. Nonetheless, I want to spell out all of the detail. Why? Because when you go into Finance 1, you're going to see other diagrams that look very similar but are quite different. So let's develop good habits right from the start. Let us check what's along the horizontal axis in the diagram. Answer, beta. What's up the vertical axis? Answer, big R. Either you or the phone disappears. Look at the graph. The horizontal axis is beta. That's our measure of systematic risk. The vertical axis, now I'm being fussy now, because we will be looking out into the future. We will be looking at incremental cash flows out into the future, and we're going to be applying our best estimate for that discount rate, big R. So I'm being careful here to label the vertical axis expected rate of return. For this module, you could just call that big R. You'll understand when you go on to Finance 1 why we have to be careful about labelling this expected value of big R. Expected in the sense of forecast, expected in the sense that economists and statisticians mean, in the sense of the average or mean of a distribution of possible values for big R. Now that's a detail. That's a detail we do not need to worry about in this module. So you could, if you wish, just relabel this vertical axis as big R. That's our cost of capital. And as I've hinted to you a number of times already in this module, the graph, the relationship between systematic risk, as measured by beta, and big R, is a straight line one. And it slopes upwards from left to right. The more systematic risk we're exposed to, the higher the rate of return we demand. Otherwise, we're not investing. It's a straight line because we've been careful to measure systematic risk correctly. Beta, and we'll only have some notion of what beta is in this module. Again, you have to wait till for Finance 1. Beta is measuring systematic risk correctly, and part of the reward for doing that, for us, is the graph we get as a straight line. The reason that individual securities that trade in the financial markets sit somewhere on this straight line is the trading activity that's going on all the time. Individual securities could drift off the line, either downwards or upwards. If they temporarily drift downwards, that security is overpriced. The rate of return is lower. An analyst who spots a security that's temporarily overpriced will issue a sell recommendation. And that additional supply of the security into the market will push its price down and at the same time raise the rate of return, so back onto the line does it go. Likewise, a security that temporarily floats above the line, so it's providing a rate of return that's greater than it should, that's because it's temporarily underpriced. Analysts who spot that sort of security will issue a buy recommendation, and the excess demand for that security will push up its price and in the process push down its rate of return. So securities that stray from this straight line won't stay off the straight line for very long. The diagram I'm showing you represents the equilibrium. It represents the long-term equilibrium, and that's what we are going to assume. For any particular investment, therefore, for any particular investment, we need to assess the systematic risk. We need to come up with the value of beta. Once we've got that value of beta, we look up to the straight line to read off the corresponding value of big R. How do we get the straight line? How do we get the straight line to begin with? We have to look at the markets. One, how do we decide what is the height of this intercept? Answer, we look in the money markets. We look to see what is the yield on the closest we can get in the real world to the risk-free asset. And as I've dropped into my speech in the past, the closest we can get to the risk-free asset is the short-dated treasury bill, typically the three-month treasury bill. So, in practice, the height of the intercept is the three-month T-bill yield. T-bill for short for treasury bill. The height of this intercept goes up and down through time as the yield on the three-month treasury bill goes up and down. And whether it goes up and down is driven by market conditions. Conditions in the money markets. Because the three-month T-bill trades in the money markets. Let's see if we can find out something about T-bills. Here is today's newspaper. That's the front page. Here is the table that's at the foot of the front page of today's FT. And I want you to focus your attention in the bottom right-hand corner of the table, and in particular, at this entry. We're in the UK. We're looking at 3M, three-month T-bills, issued on behalf of the UK sovereign government. What is the yield on the three-month T-bill at the moment? 0.69%. So a bit more than 0.5%. What's the base rate in the UK at the moment? 0.5%. So currently, the T-bill rate, the yield on three-month T-bills, is a bit higher than the base rate. Why? Because the money markets anticipate that the Monetary Policy Committee of the Bank of England is going to up the base rate at some point in the not-too-distant future. So, captured in that number, 0.69%, is the probability that the UK base rate will be higher than 0.5% at some point. Will that be this month? Will that be next month? Will that be April? We'll have to wait and see. So that's where we get our so-called risk-free rate. That's the closest we can do in terms of the risk-free rate in the UK. So, roughly speaking, at the moment, this height is about 0.7%. A little bit more than 0.5%. It changes through time. The diagram I'm drawing now is a snapshot in time. It represents the story at one point in time. It's a photograph. Come back a bit later and the story will have changed. The height of the intercept could have gone up or down. But there's something else about the line that could and does change, and that's the slope. So now we have to understand, what is it that drives the slope of the line? And the answer is, how much extra return do investors demand from investing in, say, the stock market compared to putting their money in the safe asset? And that's what this point represents. M stands for market. I said a few moments ago, the level of systematic risk associated with the market as a whole is such that its beta is 1. So beta for this particular well-diversified investment is 1, that point on the straight line represents the financial market as a whole. Because it's got systematic risk, investors demand a higher rate of return than they would if instead they put their money in the safe asset. The question is, how much extra return do they demand? That changes through time. That changes with market sentiment. But this is the important piece of information then. How much extra? Because it's extra, we give it a name. We call it a premium. Because we're looking at the market as a whole, we call it a market premium. Because we're looking at the extra rate of return that investors demand from exposing themselves to the level of systematic risk associated with the market as a whole, we call it the market risk premium. It's the extra bit, that's the premium, for exposing ourselves to the level of systematic risk associated with the market as a whole. That's the other important piece of information. Both the risk-free rate, that's the height of the intercept, and the market risk premium, that's the extra bit, both of these come from the financial markets. The risk-free rate, as I've just shown you, comes from the money markets. We look at the T-bill. The market risk premium comes from the capital markets, and it's harder to find. In fact, academics and practitioners can't agree on what is its value. I would say that in recent years, in the UK, I would say this number is somewhere in the region of 4 to 6%. But academics can't agree. And the reason they can't agree is they have to back out that number from observable market data. It's difficult. It's tricky. Both the height of the straight line, that's the risk-free rate, and the slope of the line, that's the market risk premium, both of them come to us from the financial markets, either the money market or the capital market. So these are macroeconomic variables. So in order to pin down the straight line in the diagram, we need to know two pieces of market level data. In addition, to know exactly where our investment sits on the straight line, we have to know what's its beta. And that's a piece of microeconomic information. That's particular to our individual investment. So we actually need to know three numbers. We need to know two market level pieces of data, the risk-free rate and the market risk premium. But we also need to know the fingerprint of our investment. What's its beta? So that begs the question, how do we get the beta? And the answer to that is, it depends how much you're prepared to pay. So, if I go back to the website of the FT, now the electronic version of the newspaper I showed you a moment ago, that's only available to subscribers, whereas the FT.com site is open to anyone. So you can visit this website as well as I can. So go to FT.com and pick the markets menu, and let's scroll down to equities, because we'll be thinking about the stock market. We'll be thinking about individual stocks. Let's pick a company. Well, I always think of the company that I've worked for a good part of my life for. Let's pick British Petroleum. It's in the news anyway recently. Let's pick BP shares that trade on the London Stock Exchange. So that's why I picked that one. And let's see what that turns up. At least if I could select it correctly. So there is some market information about BP shares currently. There's lots of information there that is of interest to us at different points in this module, but for this lecture, this is what I'm interested in. Because there's the beta of BP shares. It's 1.10. So you should be thinking immediately, that's bigger than one. So investment in BP shares exposes you to greater systematic risk than putting your money in a fund that will track the stock market as a whole. So if you're going to put money in BP shares, you're going to demand a greater rate of return than you would if instead you put your money in the stock market as a whole. So that's one way, that's one place in which you can find values of beta. Now, you can find it from the FT website, and it costs you nothing. And that should immediately raise your suspicions. Is this the best way? Because the best way of getting financial information like that involves paying. You need to subscribe to a paid service. You're lucky. The university library does that for you. You can use DataStream. DataStream is owned by Thomson Reuters. And the library has at least one terminal, DataStream terminal, and they'll even provide you with a little bit of training to enable you to use it if you're interested. So should you ever be doing a project as part of your degree studies that requires you to know, to have a good estimate, an estimate that you can place a lot of confidence in, an estimate of the beta of the shares of a particular company, you might want to go to the Corporate Information Centre in the main library and use the DataStream terminal. Alternatively, you can go to the Social Sciences periodical section, and if you're happy with a recent value rather than the current value, if you can live with, so what was the value of beta within the last 3 months on average, you can avail yourself of the London Business School's Risk Measurement Service. They publish a quarterly booklet, it's blue. You'll find it in the Social Sciences periodicals section. You can't walk out of the library with it, it's restricted borrowing, but you can look up the beta of whatever shares, the shares of whatever company you're interested in. The book, I'll call it the beta book for short, that book is published every 3 months. So the London Business School Risk Measurement Service publishes it 4 times a year, and that will give you a reasonably reliable value of beta. It just won't be bang up to date because it will be accurate whenever the booklet was last published. What I've shown you today on the FT.com, you can work with that, but it comes for free, so the chances are it's not quite as reliable. Perhaps you can't place the same level of confidence. I've shown you the relationship then between systematic risk and rate of return. In other words, between beta and big R, I've shown you it as a diagram. And in this module, I'm perfectly happy for you to do all your thinking and your calculating using that diagram. But at some point in your finance career, you're going to need an equation. You're going to need the equation of that straight line. And that equation is given a name. And you will learn a lot more about this next year in Finance 1. I might as well introduce it to you now. It's called the Capital Asset Pricing Model. So it's a model for pricing capital assets. Nobody calls it the Capital Asset Pricing Model. It's too long-winded. So they abbreviate it. And only idiots who don't know what it's about call it the CAPM. Whenever I hear someone say CAPM, I know they don't know what they're talking about. Because people in the know call this CAPM. That's how it's known throughout the length and breadth of the finance world. This is the CAPM, which is a shorthand name for the Capital Asset Pricing Model. The Capital Asset Pricing Model is simply the equation of the straight line on the previous slide. Check it out. The variable along the horizontal axis is beta. I attach a little I simply to identify what particular asset or security am I talking about. So that could represent BP, for instance. So the beta is the x-coordinate. The rate of return, big R, strictly speaking, the expected rate of return, that's the variable up the vertical axis. That's the y-coordinate. So this equation is of the form y equals something times x plus something else. It's beginning to sound like the equation of a straight line. And it is when we check out what are these two extra pieces? The coefficient that multiplies the beta, that is exactly the slope of the straight line. So maybe we'll call that little m, in exactly the way you'll have learned the equation of a straight line at school. So now the capital asset pricing model is reading like y equals mx plus something. What's the something? Answer, the height of the intercept. I guess you called that little c in school. So the capital asset pricing model, I now recognise, is nothing other than the equation of a straight line. It's the equation of that particular straight line we had on the previous slide. And that's so important, we give it a name. We call it the securities market line, or SML for short, just as I've labelled the diagram on the previous slide. SML stands for securities market line. That's the graph of the capital asset pricing model. The capital asset pricing model is the equation of the straight line. You can work with either in this module as you please. When you go on to finance one, you'll have to work with the equation. You might also want to draw the diagram, but you'll be doing more complicated sorts of calculations. You'll need to work with the equation. There's more than one way of looking at this equation. Perhaps you could oblige me by writing on your handout the following. Simple rearrangement. Could you take the risk-free term onto the left-hand side? It changes sign. So could you write underneath or above the typed equation, could you write expected rate of return on whatever investment we're talking about, expected rate of return minus the risk-free rate equals whatever's still on the right-hand side. And once you've done that, do you see that what the CAPM is enabling you to do is compare excess expected rates of return? On the left-hand side, you've now got the extra return you expect over and above the risk-free rate. What you expect over and above the risk-free rate on your investment. On the right-hand side, you've got two factors. One of which is the excess expected rate of return on the market as a whole. What is it that connects the two excess returns together? Answer, the beta. The beta for your investment. That's the coefficient of proportionality, if you like. Go back to the diagram, if you prefer. If your beta is bigger than 1, so we're some way to the right of 1, so we're some way higher up the line than M, what I'm saying is the extra expected rate of return, this piece, is bigger than what that is for the market. And the ratio of the two is beta. The further you are to the right, the bigger is the extra piece, the risk premium. And it scales linearly with beta. If your beta is less than 1, so you're some way to the left of this point, then your risk premium is less than the market risk premium. Again, the coefficient of proportionality is beta. So think of it this way. As you move either to the right or the left in terms of the value of beta, the extra piece, the risk premium, either expands or contracts in proportion. That's important. That's very important, because we can do a lot with that. Let's add to our intuition then. You've studied some economics, so you've met the concept of elasticity. And beta is an example of an elasticity. And here's how it works. On average, the level of the market index, is going up and down through time. Likewise, the price of any particular security. It's going up and down. When you look at the story over the long term, on average, the behaviour of a particular security will be similar to the behaviour of the market as a whole. But it won't be exactly the same. What beta is capturing is the degree to which the behaviour going up and down over the long term, the degree to which that behaviour for a particular security mimics the behaviour of the stock market as a whole. If the beta is bigger than one, then the behaviour of the individual security is exaggerated compared to the market as a whole. If the beta is less than one, the behaviour in the price of the security over the long run is subdued relative to the market as a whole. Now I can make that clearer. On average, and on average means looking at the story over the long term, on average, if the level of the market changes by 1%, if you prefer, if the return on investing in the market goes up by 1%, on average, the rate of return on your individual investment will go up by beta percent. So if beta is bigger than 1, say 1.5, then on average, for every 1% rise in the market as a whole, the price of your security will rise by 1.5%. If, on the other hand, the beta of your investment is only 0.5, then on average, for every 1% rise in the level of the market as a whole, the price of your security, or the return, more correctly, the return on your investment will only go up by 0.5%. Now you'll notice I'm stressing on average, because from any one point in time to the next, the price of your security is subject to random fluctuations. You've got to stand back and look at the story over a decent length of time. But what I'm trying to communicate to you is the behaviour of an individual investment is similar to that of the market as a whole, but it's either exaggerated or subdued depending on the value of beta, depending on whether beta is bigger than one or less than one. And there's a little numerical example that explains that. There's also a simple problem, the first problem on the seminar sheet for next week, to give you a little bit of practice. I've already mentioned how you can find estimates of beta. I've already talked a little bit about the market risk premium and how we can estimate that. So the final topic for today's lecture is all well and good if the company we're talking about that's considering investing in a new capital project, all well and good if that company is 100% financed by equity. In other words, it's owned entirely by its shareholders. It has no debt in its capital structure. You can look the length and breadth of the company and you won't find a loan anywhere on its balance sheet. If that's the case, in the jargon, if it's an all-equity financed company, I can stop now. I've nothing further to say to you. Unfortunately for me, the great majority of companies in the real world are part equity, part debt financed. So I've got one last piece of the story to tell you, and that's on this slide. At the end of the day, whenever a company is appraising a new capital project, it has to decide on the correct value of big R to use as the discount rate. The value of big R it should use reflects how the company as a whole is financed. What proportion of the company overall is financed by equity? What proportion of the company overall is financed by debt? Now you must be asking yourself, why does that matter? And the answer is quite simple. The shareholders, the equity holders, they have a level of big R, they have a rate of return that they will demand. the debt holders, that's the lenders, they have a rate of return that they will demand on their investment. And you've guessed it, the two rates of return are not the same. So we need to settle on some way of averaging the two rates of return. But before we do that, let's understand, why are they not the same? Here's the answer. In general, the rate of return that the debt holders, the lenders, will demand is less than the rate of return that the shareholders, the equity holders, will demand. And there's a very good reason. The lenders know, all being well, the company will pay the interest that's due on the loans on time and in full, and the company will pay back the loan whenever the loan matures. So unless this company gets itself into difficulties, all being well, it continues to trade, the lenders can sleep pretty soundly at night without having to worry about, will the company miss an interest payment? Will the company only make an interest payment in part? The answer is it won't. Interest payments on debt and the repayment of debt in full at the end of the term, these are legally enforceable. So the level of risk that the lenders are exposed to is less. So they demand a lower rate of return on their investment. The rate of return they demand for giving the money in the first place to the company in the form of a loan is less than the shareholders. How come? Because the interest payments on the debt and the repayment of any debt that matures, the company must make those payments first. So whatever surplus cash flows the company has at its disposal, the lenders are at the head of the queue for any payouts. If we're in a world where there's a tax man, and there isn't a tax man on this slide, we'll learn later about that. If there's a tax man in the story, he's next in line. Because once the company has met the interest payments on its debt, the next thing it must do is pay its corporation tax bill. Meanwhile, the shareholders, which are standing at the back of the queue, are twiddling their thumbs waiting for their turn. And it might just be the case that by the time the company gets to the shareholders, there isn't a lot of surplus cash left. That's okay. Bad news for the shareholders might mean the company has to cut the dividend, might not, because that's rather dramatic, but I'm afraid the company is free to do what it wants. It's not subject to any legal restrictions regarding the shareholders. So here's the bottom line. In the best of times, there's lots of cash flow to go around. Easy to make the interest payments. No difficulty paying the corporation tax bill, and a tidy surplus to keep the shareholders happy with a nice juicy dividend. Everybody's happy. But what about the times when the company is struggling? Maybe we're going through a recession. They've got to meet the interest payments on the debt. They've got to pay their corporation tax bill. Bad news for the shareholders. I'm afraid over the past year, things have been difficult. There isn't very much, if anything, we can give you. So the shareholders are exposed to the biggest difference in how much is there for us. Because they're at the end of the queue, they're exposed to the biggest variations in cash flow payouts. Let me say that in a more sophisticated way. The shareholders are exposed to the greatest risk, and therefore they demand the highest rate of return. Now, we're going to keep the story as simple as we can get away with in this module. There'll be debt holders and equity holders. Debt plus equity will make up the whole story of how the company is financed. So we only need to worry about two values of big R. The value of big R that the debt holders, the lenders, demand, and the value of big R that the shareholders, the equity holders, demand. The question then is, what value, what single value of big R should the company use as the discount rate when it comes to appraise a new project? And here's the answer. Provided the project is of the average level of risk for the company as a whole. In other words, it's typical of the sort of project that the company does. There's what we do. We take the rate of return that the debt holders demand, we take the rate of return that the equity holders demand, and we calculate a particular weighted average. The weights in the average reflect what proportion of the overall funding, debt plus equity, is made up in the form of debt, and what proportion of the overall funding, debt plus equity, is accounted for by equity. And the only other detail you need to remember is this is a finance module. So when I talk about the value of debt or the value of equity, I mean the market values. I don't mean the book values. Now, generally for our purposes, there isn't a lot of difference between book value and market value of debt. But there can be big differences between the book value and the market value of equity. So let's be clear. Big E here is market capitalization. It's number of shares that trade in this company times the share price. The debt is something we don't have to worry about in this module because we'll assume, you'll learn when you go on to finance too, that it's a rather heroic assumption. We'll assume the debt is risk-free. That just keeps the story simpler. I'll tell you more next week.